Brian Boitano has joined us on Sports Byline USA. Brian, I mentioned about the disappointment of 87 and then the magic of 1988. What type of attitude did you take in to 1988 as far as competition?
Well, you know what? I had to be realistic about the whole thing. I knew that it was going to be a pretty intense year because I won the world title in 86, and then my chief rival, Brian Orser, won it in 87. And so they were building, you know, they were building it into a big battle. And the thing that I decided before the Olympics was, you know, I went through this whole soul-searching thing of, like, you know, what am I doing this for? Do I really, is my life really over if I don't win the Olympic gold medal? I mean, because if it, I mean, the possibility, I mean, you know, the odds of, you know, one, that one person being you, it comes a lot into your control, but there's a lot of other things involved in it. And I sort of came to the conclusion that what I really liked was the process. I really loved going in and training. And I sort of focused on that. I was like, you know, okay, whatever happens in the competition, just enjoy the training. Just enjoy comparing yourself every day to the day before and getting better and better and better. And if you win, you win. If you don't, you're going to, you know, you can put in another 4 more years and, you know, just focus on what you enjoy doing. And that really turned me around. I didn't feel like I needed to be an Olympic gold medalist to have a fantastic life. I was just enjoying the process.
Is it difficult on figure skaters or anybody who's an Olympic athlete to focus in on the fact that what you do in your particular case against Brian Orser, you know, that long form program, that it comes down to this and you don't get another chance really in the Olympics until another 4 years? How does one deal with that?
That is what makes figure skating so... That is the whole difficulty factor, because, I mean, not only are you doing an Olympic, an Olympic event, and it's very athletic, you have to make it look like you're having a good time. I mean, that is part of figure skating. You have to make it look like you're not nervous. You have to make people feel comfortable. But yet, when it's your time, no matter how you feel, you have an exact time that you're going to get on the ice, and in 4 minutes, you're going to be shot out of a cannon, and you have to perform perfectly. And if you don't, then you are going to have to wait or retire, or your dreams aren't going to come true. And your mind thinks about all this stuff when it's happening. That's just it. It's your mind when you're competing is a snowball. It's really hard if things are going in a negative direction to turn that off and turn it into a positive direction. It's like a snowball, and it doesn't stop because your mind keeps talking to you during the performance. So that's why it's really important, in my opinion. The way I always, you know, felt about it is I always wanted to keep my mind from even going there. Like, just stop it, nip it in the bud, make sure it doesn't start going in the negative direction, because that's really what the excitement is for people watching figure skating, too, because it's, you know, that the falls can happen, and if the falls happen, the disappointment comes with it.
I remember I was in Spokane, Washington, getting ready to broadcast a basketball game, and I happened to walk by a newsstand, and I saw the picture on the front page. It was Debbie Thomas looking through the glass at Katarina Witt out on the ice in practicing, and I looked at her face, and I could see, you know, if you look at body language, Brian, I could see that she was really uptight, and I didn't think she was going to win from at least what I had seen. She did not win, of course, and so I'm going to use that as an intro into the way you felt as you stepped onto the ice, knowing that you had to have this long-form program and the success, and you were flawless in that, but you also seemed very cool, and I know that's probably deceiving, but you were very cool as I watched you in just your body language. How did you approach that?
Well, you know, the thing is, Ron, that I knew that if I needed any chance, because Brian Orser was really, I mean, we were co-favorites, but he was really the favorite. He was, 4 years before that, he was second to Scott Hamilton in the 84 Olympics. He had won a world title the year before. He was carrying the flag for Canada, in Calgary, for the Olympics. He was really their only hope for an Olympic gold medal in those Olympics. So I was like, I knew that, like, you know, I might have to put in another 4 years and wait till Albertville. So, I mean, I was looking at it as, you know, the only hope I have at all of winning an Olympic gold in this competition is if I'm flawless not just the 3 days of competition, but the compulsory figures, the short and long. I had to be flawless the whole week at the competition during practices. I knew that that was the only way that I could do it. And so when you sort of put that expectation on yourself, you're like, okay, I'm not going to be able to do that. So you know what? I'm going to just do as best as I can, and you know, just like, you know, keep plugging away at it. And so it gets down to the long program night, and I've been, you know, like I said, I've had a great week. I've had a really great week, and it's coming down to the long program. And what we talked about earlier about that confidence, you know, it's like that whole week of doing perfect run-throughs of the longs and short programs, it's what you carry out there on the ice with you. And when you're alone and the music starts, you really rely on those moments where you're like, I know. I mean, if you tell yourself, I've seen a lot of skaters say, I know I can do it, but I don't believe them. You have to really believe it if you say to yourself, you're like, I know I can do this. It's a whole different focus.
Can anything prepare you for being an Olympic champion, especially in a high-profile sport like figure skating?
Not really. I was so, even after I won the gold and I was in the Olympic Village for a week, I had no idea what was going to happen when I went out. In fact, I remember one of the skating roommates went to go do like Hollywood Squares, the TV game show. It was like my roommate was Peter Uppelgarten. He was a pair bronze medalist, so they had him on Hollywood Squares. So he flew back to the States for one day to do that, and then he came back to the Olympic Village, and he's like, oh, my God, you're not going to even believe it. You are not – I can't even explain it, but you're not going to believe it. And I'm like, whatever, you know, I had a great time in the Olympics. And then, you know, it's really, you know, it's especially in those days, it's really life-changing. And you have to learn how to adapt very slowly.
You turned professional in 1988, and following the Olympics, you went on to dominate competitions in the professional ranks, winning 10 straight professional competitions, including 5 consecutive World Professional Championship titles as well. But you mentioned a little bit early at the outset of the interview about that itch. You weren't sure that you were ready to really retire. Was that the force behind you pushing to be able to compete once again in the Olympics in 1994?
That is exactly what was the force behind it. And, you know, I had been on tour. Like I said, I had kept up my skating. I'd been doing all the tricks that I had, you know, done in the 88 Olympics on a regular basis. In fact, I felt even more confident because I did actually more performances on the road, on tour, and in professional competitions than I had ever done as an amateur before the Olympics. So I was trying to put out the same stuff that I was doing in the Olympics every night on the road. So it gave me that, you know, sort of a lot of confidence, and that's what made me push to get back into the Olympics and to do the Olympics again.
How did you feel when you finished 6th in the competition in 94?
You know, I felt, when I finished, I felt bad after the short program because, you know, in retrospect, I had a bad injury that I got about a year before when I was touring on the road. I had a really bad knee injury, and I had such trouble training. I could only do a certain amount of repetition of certain triple jumps. Like, you know, I could only do 2 triple lefts a day, whereas usually I would do 10 or 12. I could only do 1 triple flip a day, where I would usually do 10 or 12. So it was like I really was restricted, and I felt like it was something that made me, I wasn't able to prepare as well as I did. So in retrospect, I always wonder if I should have withdrawn, but I sort of made a commitment to doing it, and I really wanted to see that through. And I still felt like even though I was injured, I could still compete with, you know, with the big boys at that time. So, I put myself out there, and I felt really disappointed after the short program because I fell in the short program, and it was a really unusual mistake. I should have, you know, it's like I hadn't made that mistake in years, probably. I think I made one mistake in all the short programs of my life, and one of them was in the Olympics in Lillehammer. So I was really disappointed. But you know what made me feel good is going on tour a month after that and taking the tour around the country and seeing that the audience was supportive.
You certainly have had the vision of looking forward and not behind you. And, of course, I love the South Park reference to you. What would Brian Boitano do? But also in 2009, the Food Network debuted a new series entitled What Would Brian Boitano Make? Now, I've known you for a long time, and I always I want everybody to know, I always kid Brian about when can I come to your restaurant? Because it's always been a dream of yours to have a restaurant.
It has. And I'm still, you know, that seed is still planted. And I would, I got to tell you, everybody that I tell that to, I can't tell you how many negative things I get about. You don't want to open a restaurant. You got to be there all the time. And you don't want to open a restaurant. It's hard work. And, you know, it's like everybody has such negative things to say about restaurants. But you know what? I do love it, and I love entertaining. I have a big family, and they all like cooking with me. And, you know, someday, I don't know if it'll happen. The thing is, I've been waiting to sort of, you know, have a little bit of extra time, like really retire and not have anything to do and be bored, and then all of a sudden I'm going to have a restaurant. But I haven't slowed down, so it's like, I don't know when I'm going to have the time to do it, but hopefully someday.
Well, I mentioned about the Food Network show, but also you have a cookbook act. Tell me a little bit about it.
Well, you know what? My cookbook, it just came out. It's actually sitting in front of me now because it's the first day I've seen it. And it's called What Would Brian Boitano Make? And it's really a lot of the focus and the inspiration came through my travels around the world. I mean, I've been traveling around the world since I've been 14 years old. So a lot of the inspiration is from those trips and the food that I ate on those trips. And the other thing is family traditions. I really want to keep my old family traditions alive, and I want to create new family traditions for my extra large family. So those are the real inspirations behind the cookbook. And so, you know, the recipes themselves are, you know, fun, easily accessible. They lean toward the healthy side. And really great for, you know, anyone with an active lifestyle. And that's basically everyone these days.
When you think about your creativeness on the ice, is there any correlation to that in the creativeness in the kitchen as well?
Do you know what? There are so many parallels with cooking and skating. It's all the layers. It's the layers of skating from costumes to performance to music to lights. And then with cooking, it's, you know, the visual, how it looks on the plate, how it smells, how it tastes. If there's crunch, there's sour. I mean, it's all these different complexities all melded together. So, I thought about that, but they really, really, really are parallel.
What do you want your legacy to be, Brian?
Oh, my gosh. I have no idea. I don't know. I've been asked that question before, and I don't know. I guess, you know, it feels really good to inspire a younger generation. For me, I get the biggest thrill when, you know, a young skater is excited to meet me or has seen my performances, or if I can help them. I love doing that, getting a call from, you know, young skater and saying like, hey, I'm having trouble doing this. Can you help me? And I help them. I really like doing that. So if I can be of an inspiration to someone or a skater or anybody, I guess that wouldn't be a bad legacy to have, huh?
We only have 1 minute left, but one of the things that I know about skating, because I've been around the skating family from time to time with you and others, is the comradeship. Was that something that you felt bad about losing as you moved on in your life a little bit?
No, because, you know, you still keep that closeness with the skaters. And now, you know, it's an interesting thing. I go back to the National Figure Skating Championships every year, and I still run into people that I competed in my first nationals when I was 13 years old. I mean, where else in the world and in your life, in anyone's life, can you still run into every year if you want to? People that you've met throughout your life like that. It's this amazing gift of relationships with people that you have a lot in common with, you know, this love of this sport. And you get to stay connected to them all the time. I mean, when Scott Hamilton, I did Scott Hamilton Cares for Cleveland Clinic, the cancer show, and he had all the Olympic champions from the United States, and we'd only all been together one at a time at the national championships. But I got to tell you, I stand backstage and I see Dick Button and Peggy Fleming and Tenley Albright and Carol Heiss and Scott and Dorothy Hamill. And I think, oh my God, I can't believe I belong to this group. It's so cool, you know? And, you know, it's just for a lifetime, and you'll always be friends and be connected in some way to them.
Thanks, Brian.
I can't wait to see you again.
1988 gold medalist Brian Boitano. We continue on America's Sports Talk Show.